Welcome to the Lucid Body House podcast. I'm Faye Simpson, your host. Super excited about my guest today, with whom I've had the pleasure of working with and with whom I would literally jump through hoops to work with again, the talented young theater director, Michelle Ross. Michelle is a director and creative collaborator based in New York City who specializes in the development of new work and aesthetic world building. She's developed work with Melis Aker, Hound Dog, Aziza Barnes, Nana, Agnes Berinsky, A Song of Songs, Daniela de Jesus, Mambo Sauce, Ellen Winter, This House is Your House, and directed the world premiere of Jeremy O. Harris's Black exhibition at the Bushwick Star, where she is now the Associate Artistic Director. She got her BFA at NYU. Michelle, welcome.
Hi, Faye. Thank you so much for having me and for the beautiful introduction.
Of course. You are my favorite director. I've told everybody that, and I don't hold back.
Oh, you're so sweet.
So, you know, my first question today, because I really don't know, is what is your beginnings in the theater? Like, did you have a childhood dream, or did you start as an actor, or how did you end up being a director?
Oh my gosh, I love this question so much. I love hearing where people's origin stories are because I always find them to be so unique to the person. Yeah. And I think that in my case, I grew up in a family of artists. My mom and my dad are both incredibly creative people. They play musical instruments, and my uncles are performers and writers, and my grandparents are painters. And so I feel I grew up in just an environment that really encouraged creativity. And I feel like my earliest theatrical memory is performing like mini news shows for my grandmother when I was 5 years old. And I just loved the attention. I loved the all eyes on me and getting to create characters and dress up in like these crazy elaborate costumes that I really just sourced from my grandmother's closet. I think that it was around that time that I just sort of got the acting bug, if you will. And my first role I played the grandmother in a production of Babar at my elementary school. And no one wanted to play the grandmother. And I was like, I will take on this job. Like, I will take on this nuanced role, if you will. So I think from a young age, it was really like that creative environment and that sort of love of performance and making people excited and happy was certainly my draw to theater. And I think that as I moved through my elementary school, middle school, high school, I was fortunate enough to just have really incredible theatrical mentors around me, which really encouraged me and gave me the confidence to feel like I could pursue this with my life. Which I think that a lot of people maybe have that dream of becoming an artist or being in the theater. And now that I'm, multiple decades at this point into this craft, it's quite remarkable. Like, I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing the dream. I can't believe I'm doing the dream.
You're so lucky that you have that kind of supportive family. That is a little... Well, unusual in that I hear so many origin stories where the last thing the parents and grandparents wanted was them to go into the theater or places where they couldn't make a living. And so what a opportunity you had. What a gift.
Yes. And they were, and my parents especially, like all the way through the decision to go to college, it was like, we just want to support what makes you happy and what you're passionate about. And that was theater. I was able to zoom in on that at such a young age, and I'm still doing it.
Are you there?
Yes, I lost you for a couple of seconds, but now I can hear you great.
Okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and D.C. proper, Northwest D.C., not Maryland or Virginia. Washington, D.C., baby.
Oh, that's right. I think we did discuss that because I grew up in Baltimore.
Yes!
Close.
Love it.
Oh, okay. So, so I know you have been at Sundance Theater Lab where you were a fellow, right?
Yes.
And that was, did you say it was during the pandemic?
Yes. So I was in the last Sundance Theater Lab cohort, which was the year 2020. And we got these acceptance letters maybe in February of 2020. So it was this dream come true of not only being accepted, but getting to work in Utah. You know, that was the dream. And then unfortunately, the pandemic went down and the program was entirely virtual. And so we did this 3 weeks all online, all on Zoom. And we had artists from like all over the world. My theater cohort, we had artists from Kenya. We had artists from Iran. It was very, very inspiring. You know, at that point in the pandemic, just being in creative conversation
was such a gift
in a time where like truly it felt like theater in particular was just never going to come back. Or like at that time, you know, we weren't seeing tons of Zoom productions even, right? And so the Sundance Lab was a really special and formative memory for me because I got to collaborate with a dear friend, Aziza Barnes, on their incredible play, Nana. Oh. And I also just got to meet so many incredible artists internationally, which is just such a blessing and very unique to the Sundance experience.
And would it have been that international if it had been live, or was it, you know, because of Zoom that everybody from all over the country could join?
It's a really good question. My understanding is that Sundance does try to incorporate and bring international artists every year, but I do wonder if there was something about the accessibility of this year that allowed them to have more of a global reach. But Sundance is, you know, so special in the way that they really tried to target and reach international artists for their programming to be in conversation with US-based artists.
So, so amazing. I've always wanted to do that. And were you there as a director?
I was. I was there, like I said, collaborating with Aziza Barnes, who's an incredible playwright. And Aziza and I went to school together. We were in playwrights together. And Nana is a play that Aziza has been talking to me for maybe like 5 to 7 years about.
Wow.
And yeah, it was just this really incredible moment of taking this idea and really realizing it. Aziza had, I think, about like 70 pages of material that they had written over the course of the past year and a half. So like 2019 to 2020. And that workshop was our first opportunity of hearing the text live. And we just had such a remarkable room of actors.
Oh, amazing.
And, you know, it got me so painfully excited at the prospect of this project happening live.
It has not materialized live yet. Yet.
But I am very excited at the future of Nana. And I'm very excited to gather that company again of performers, hopefully, to continue the good work.
Oh, fantastic. It's always good to have something boiling in the works, right? Yeah. That you know is gonna come up. You were also the Women's Project Directors Lab.
Yes.
And what was that about?
So the Women's Project is a really interesting, it's a really interesting program. It's over the course of 2 years and they pick 5 directors, 5 producers and 5 playwrights. And you basically have 2 meetings per month, one as an entire lab, and then a smaller meeting with your sort of individualized cohort. So this sort of really helps bring a sense of community for directors and for writers and for producers. And I think that, you know, in my particular cohort, again, deeply affected by the pandemic, our entire lab was online and digital. Yeah. But, you know, that sort of commonplace of knowing, okay, every month I have this digital space to go to bring my questions, my frustrations, my concerns about this craft, you know, all of that was like the support system of the lab, I think, was quite remarkable. And it's been around for, you know, almost 30 years.
Yeah.
When you look at that roster of directors in particular, you know, it's just such an honor to be in conversation and a part of that sort of lineage of directors.
Well, what were you paired with a playwright and then you worked on that? What was the playwright you were paired with?
Yes. So I was paired with the incredible Nambi E. Kelly. Mm-hmm. And we worked on a play in process that Nambi was writing, really anchored on her familial history. It was a very, very moving piece. It was untitled. So Unfortunately, can't give you a title for the project. But Nambi's writing is so poetic. And I think that we were a really great match together, not only because of that sort of aesthetic sensibility, but also I think that our point of view as artists come from a really similar place. And that was also just really intriguing to get paired with, you know, we got paired by the WP folks.
Wow.
So
that's risky.
I was, yeah. But I was really grateful to have gotten to work with Nambi on this very special project.
Wow. You've had so many, I don't know, I won't say it's a break because you're so talented. And for our listeners, when Michelle walks in a room, there's a bright light in the room. So I'm sure that people see that and want to work with you. So you've had these opportunities for a good reason.
I know
you were associate director with Liliana Blaine Cruz at the Lincoln Center, Mary Seacole.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely. One of the most profound and important experiences in my life, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Liliana, you know, I didn't go to grad school, and no shade on people that do go to grad school. grad school can be your path 100%. It just was not my path. And so I did what I call the grad school of life.
Right.
And, I was very, very fortunate to spend most of that grad school of life working under Liliana Blaine Cruz and Lila Neugebauer. And
wow.
In particular, Mary Seacole, it was the world premiere of that play by Jackie Sibley's Drury, a writer who is just an absolute legend and someone who I admire so much. Being in that room on the first day, I remember just being so overwhelmed, definitely feeling the imposter syndrome of like, how the hell did I get into this room? Like, this doesn't make any sense. But it was just one of the most alive theatrical processes I've ever been a part of. Every single member of that room, the cast, the stage management, the directing team, the writer, everyone was just so dialed in on executing this incredibly ambitious and deeply, deeply personal work that, you know, has so many profoundly theatrical gestures. So seeing Liliana figure it out in real time, you know, that's the gift of being an associate, is like you get to not only be in support of someone else's vision, but you get to see that person make their vision come to life, right? And seeing Liliana attack this play with the attention and rigor of detail to the text as well as to the design, I think was just a really life-changing experience for me, mostly because I think that encouraged me to be really ambitious about the worlds that I want to build theatrically.
Right.
And Liliana, I think, has just been such an incredible mentor and friend in that regard of motivating me to go for the biggest version of the idea, like not settling for safety,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, Liliana, I think that she was at Yale when I was teaching there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I believe she took some directing. I taught the directors for a few classes, but then she came to Africa in our Theater for Social Change program in Tanzania.
Wow.
So I did get the opportunity to glean her very creative way of looking at the world. Very individual. For our listeners, Michelle and I met at NYU. She came in to direct Mary Seacole with our third year in grad acting, and I was able to be her assistant director, movement director.
Yes.
Which is my favorite role in life, movement director, intimacy choreographer. Which was a riot because this was the first staged play since the pandemic.
Yeah.
And nobody could touch each other. And nobody could touch the same props.
Uh-huh.
Nobody could touch anyone else's costume. So the movement, for me, it was a blast. I was having a great time. You know, someone's combing the hair of someone else 6 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole bed changing.
Yes.
The whole bed changing. I mean, it was a creative opportunity. And being in the room with you made me feel, first of all, so appreciated. And also, I got, like, the way you described Liliana, it was how I watched you directing, where you took your time with the actors to unpack the moments slowly and with them and together. It was great. There was not a rush. It was not, this is my dream and I'm going to make everybody fit into it. I just loved how you took the bodies in front of you and were working, like weaving with these colors that were in front of you. I've fell in love with working with you ever since.
Oh, Faye, you're just the best. I mean, everyone listening to this podcast knows that, like, Faye is an actual genius. So, like, the honor was truly mine. I just remember, you know, I remember that process so vividly for so many different reasons. One, you beautifully articulated, which was just, like, all of the limitations that we as a creative team had to deal with, just being quite literally the only show happening live in New York City at the time that we were making it, which was November of 2020, people. So, you know,
everyone in masks. All the actors were in masks.
Everyone was in masks. Yes. And it was crazy. And I think that, like, I was really nervous because, you know, I think that there's a level of nerves that inherently come with being a director and leading a room. You know, I think that you want to do a quote unquote good job. You want to be energized. You want people to be excited about the vision that you have. And I was so nervous that the limitations were going to be too much for us as a company to really be able to sink our teeth into this play. And then, weirdly enough, and I hope that you agree with me, Faye, all of those limitations quite beautifully worked in our favor in terms of telling this deeply provocative, moving story about caretaking. How do you create intimacy? How do you create the intimacy of caretaking when you literally cannot have human beings touch one another? When, like, you know.
And the subject matter is the distance. People caretaking other people with this huge distance, cultural difference, distance between them.
Yes.
And how the play reveals that distance and yet succumbs to the intimacy is just such a beautiful thing about that play.
Yes. And you were so vital to the success of that production. And I think that our collaboration and the way that we worked together in terms of the problem solving and compositionally would not have been possible without both of at the frame together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a dream to have someone that, you know, I would say, like, you and I have a really similar ethos in terms of how we move through move in a room. And I certainly think that, like, the approach to caretaking the performers on stage, you know,
creating an
environment of safety for exploration and for discovery is so vital to the success of any process. And I think that we created an unbelievable container for all of us to figure it out together.
Yeah.
And I think that that was why it was so special, was that it was such a fragile time. It's such a fragile time in the world.
I know.
You know?
Yeah.
Biden won the election on our on our last day of tech. I don't know if you remember,
but we went running into the park.
Absolutely.
Remember? We were all running there, absolutely, celebrating and dancing.
Absolutely. Because that is a part of the humanity of the process too. You know, that was a moment of exhalation for everyone that, you know, wasn't necessarily connected to the work, but in many ways was connected to the work.
Yes.
And so I think that, like, you know, I look back on that time with such fondness, not only for like all of the performers that were in that company, my collaboration with you, but just that time in literal history,
yes,
was like, right, it was a shift into the light, you know, yes, after a really, really, really dark couple of years.
Yes. Yes. I am thinking about how, what collaboration is when you're talking about us being in the room together, and how, you know, I don't think there are many directors who are not collaborators. Mm. I've been in the room with many directors and, you know, I can do the choreography or I can do the intimacy or I can, but they're not collaborators in that they are not working. Like, you throw an idea, I throw an idea, you throw an idea. There is something that it's like the, in my language, the sixth chakra, that it's like an exploded six where you're open to the process and not stuck on the one voice of the director. And so that it's like, I feel like a child in a playground when I'm in the room with you, because you are a collaborator and there's just a mutual respect. And it also, and I wanted to ask you about this, you seem, you know, I see storytelling in the bodies. Is the body telling the story?
Mm-hmm.
And you do as well.
Yes, 1,000%. I think that my sort of directorial gaze does have a choreographic quality to it, in that I'm a very, very visual director.
Yeah.
And for me, composition is so central to how you communicate story. And composition includes and is built by the bodies on stage. And so how those bodies are moving, the intensity and specificity of those movements, those
right,
all, if they are calibrated with care and, again, with rigor,
yeah,
I think can deeply shape a theatrical experience.
Yeah.
And so for me, I am not a capital C choreographer, right? But that is where I think that the gift of our collaboration really took off, was that I saw the way that you spoke to the performers, the way that you were able to elicit exciting sort of entry points into their bodies,
yeah,
which then translates to a profound sort of entry to language. When a performer feels grounded in their body and is telling the truth in their body, mm-hmm, the language flies, right? And
yeah,
so that sort of physical piece feels really essential to me in like the building, in the building of collaboration, and certainly in the process of the composition. And I honestly learned so much from you in the way that, again, you invite curiosity,
mm-hmm,
and never, I think, lead with an assumption of what something should be. Everything always feels like an offering.
Right.
And that to me is so, that to me is so inspiring. And certainly in the way that I hope to lead a room, per your sort of articulation of like, not the singular voice. I think that, like, I hope that in my directorial practice to sort of break those hierarchical structures, that the director is the singular person in the space who knows what the idea is or has all of the answers. Like, I actively try to move into my rehearsal spaces with the deep, and I mean deep, belief that I need every single person in that space,
yeah,
to help me figure it out.
Yeah, and they do. That's why you would start after a break, you would say, okay, geniuses, we're back. And I was so like, love that, because everyone feels heard and in the room. And, you know, it was when I was doing Mary Seacole with you and also Dance Nation at NYU, there's a a slight difference because those students have taken Lucid Body from me. So they've learned the language, the complexity of visceral acting. And so, you know, saying to them, get that imploded three fired up and hide it under here, they get it. But working with you, what did we do? Song of Songs.
Yes.
We did. And Hound Dog.
So much. We've done so much together.
I know. But those two, I was working with actors who hadn't had the work.
Right.
Right. So it's a little, it's different. It's just takes a little bit more time, which you gave me when I was there, but to get people connected to thinking about what their inner emotional track was, mm-hmm. that was a little separate from the dialogue.
Yes.
You know, what's going on before the dialogue? Why the dialogue is coming out because of the complexity of what's going on.
Yes. And I think that in both of those projects that you named, Hound Dog and A Song of Songs, there is a level of surrealism that that both of those plays are like enamored with.
Yeah.
And so I think that that sort of space to really explore intention and to give you again, like that sort of opportunity to bring your offerings to the room, I think was so vital to then moving into the deeper understanding of how language operates in right. both of those places, in both of those plays.
Yeah.
And I think both of those plays also have really gnarly relationships with time, you know?
Yeah.
Hound Dog, we're moving mm-hmm. forwards and backwards in time constantly. A Song of Songs, similarly, it's like you end up like, you know, multiple years in the future by the end of the play. And so—
And in the Land of the Dead.
And in the Land of the Dead, yes.
We were wandering around there. Yeah.
We were wandering around everywhere. But yeah, like it's with both of those projects, there's such vivid worlds of opportunity. And I think that again, your work on those projects took it to another level in terms of specificity of embodiment. And certainly I think in creating dynamic moments of movement, which I think for me is always something that I yearn for. It's like,
yeah.
We have to be able to understand a story in two ways. I feel like I've told you this before.
Yeah.
This is one of my directing pillars, which is like, you need to be able to understand a play like this. I have my hands over my ears, right? And then you need to also be able to understand a play like this. And now I have my hands over my eyes.
My eyes, right. I love that. Yeah.
You need to have two masteries of a world so that there's multiple entries of understanding. And I think that that movement piece, that physical piece is so important to me for many reasons. But I think that one of the most important that like I think about all the time is my mom. My mom speaks English as her second language. And I think that when she goes to see theater, she's looking at composition and color and, you know, costume design and the ways that, you know, what are the ways that these storytellers are helping me understand this outside of the heightened English language, right? And so I think that that sort of little kernel keeps me really motivated, you know, in all of the pieces that I do, that I want it to be understood by as many of the senses as possible.
Yeah, that I was doing research in preparation for today and saw a couple in an interview, you talk about that you want to be involved in world building. And you yeah. also talk about building rigorous images. And I think it speaks to what you were just talking about, but speak more about it. World building.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the gifts of my grad school of life trajectory was getting to work, like I said, under Liliana and Lila, who are just, I think, two of the best directors, like point blank period. Like they just have such specific relationships to design and the way that they activate world building in their process. And I think that when I reflect back to my college time and certainly in this grad school of life time, my brain has always been electrified by design. And I think that when you have a profound understanding of the way that the container or the world works, everything else makes sense. You know what I mean? And I think that like the emphasis on rigorous world building and rigorous image is really tied to like the desire to have the most specific version of the story that I can tell on stage. So I really am a director that places so much time and care into the pre-production process, into building a really robust design team and creative team that's all on the same sort of aesthetic page, so that we are all working towards the image building that is in consideration of the ultimate story we're trying to tell, while also being, I think, unique and sort of design centered.
Yeah, you know how it's so interesting because words and images all strike each person differently.
Yes, totally.
And, you know, when you say world building, even though that's a large, you know, world, building a world that we want to live in, you know, building a world, showing the world the problem so that we can start to find solutions. But I'm thinking, you know, world building starts with when you have a rigorous image, an image that is so strong that the person in the audience is so affected by it, they understand something about themselves. And by understanding something about themselves, then they can actually start to change how they enact with the world, which is then world building.
100%. That's so beautifully articulated. And it makes me think about the last image of Mary Seacole, which I think was one of the hardest things for us to build as a company, because the play leads us in this very open-ended and simultaneously definitive sort of point of relation between caregiver and person receiving care, right? Yes. Which in this play also happens to be racialized.
Yes.
And, you know, the way that we built that final moment was about first understanding the arc of the journey of our Marys, right? Plural Marys. Yeah. For those who know, yeah, you know. And it's like, how do we arrive at a thesis, right? With an image. And that image was built in thinking about the weight of the entire play.
Yeah.
Existing on the shoulders of the caretaker, right? That we actually need to land that this final image is most painful for the caretaker.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I think that, like, you know, after that sort of understanding, and then you add our list of parameters that we were just like working with. Like,
but wasn't it the last image? Mary, wasn't everybody yelling for her?
Well, there is that moment right before, but the final image is sort of like we sort of had our caretaker with their care receiver,
yes,
sort of in 6 feet proximity, mm-hmm, and we had, you know, you helped each of the actors on stage create a very, very simple physical gesture of caretaking, which was so tailored to the person, right? And to the relationship that character had with the person that they were giving care to, right? And to me, that was like a really beautiful synthesis of, I think, everything that you just talked about, which is like how the world is affecting sort of motion, but also how all of that motion within the container is affecting an audience's understanding and making them think for themselves about when have they been the caretaker and when have they been the person on the receiving side, right?
Yes.
To activate the consciousness of audience members to contend with their privilege, right?
Right.
That is what I think that the last moment of our show really aims to do. And I think was successful.
And also to see for an audience, especially a white audience, to see what to be able to have to face what has been.
Yes.
All of the racism and colonial thinking and all of that, but to face it in that story and then so that then they can move forward. I think so many times people can't face the past, therefore just physically in their bodies, that blindness that I am not connecting to that yes. place of feeling the sorrow for what my ancestors did. So that's what the play was brilliant to do, that because it was facing, you had to face it and look at it,
yeah.
receive it so that one can move forward in one's behavior.
Yes. Yes. So beautifully articulated.
You know, I've done a lot of intimacy choreography for you along with the other, and I want to talk just briefly about it because it has blown up now.
Yes.
Intimacy coordinators, choreographers, directors. I prefer to call myself an intimacy choreographer. Yeah. But what is, and I know you've been in the room with probably many others, what is helpful about an intimacy choreographer and what is not helpful?
Great question. So I think that intimacy work, I'm so thrilled that it is sort of blowing up now because yeah. I feel like, you know, theater, film has been a really historically abusive workplace.
Totally. Oh my God.
And like the exploitation, particularly of femme bodies in these yeah. workplaces has been deeply... deeply under-recognized. And so the sort of turn now of a lot of theater companies and processes in whatever medium, bringing in professionals to help build and create, again, I think immediately of the word safety, to create safety for performers and collaborators alike.
Mm-hmm.
To intimate moments. And I want to be clear that intimacy work is not just I'm kissing someone on stage, or that it's necessarily just sexual.
No.
It's any moment of touch that requires attention, right?
Or not touch. Like those three couples at the end of Mary's sequel was very intimate. That was active space. That intimacy is between their bodies. That's
correct.
Just as intimate. Correct. Yeah.
Correct. And so, yeah, that like intimacy work is not just about a romantic or sexual.
No.
thing, but it's actually about, again, connection and safety. And so when the best intimacy coordinator I've ever worked with is you, duh.
Thank you.
But like, I think that what makes a really amazing intimacy coordinator is sort of an energy that is able to read the various needs of a room, because I think that that is an important part of also being a director, right?
Yeah.
Is it's like not everyone has the same relationship to their body,
right.
to their acting process. Everyone comes in with different baggage and different needs. And I think that an intimacy coordinator is excellent at synthesizing those needs to first and foremost create, hopefully, a sort of repeatable gesture or sequence that makes all participating bodies feel good, right?
Yeah.
And feel safe in the repetition of it, right? And so I think that that sort of synthesis piece is key. I think that the second important piece, and this is what I think is like one of your most profound skills, is listening. And listening is not just to like the needs being expressed into the room. Listening is also watching bodies and understanding how to calibrate and make adjustments to not only what the director sort of is craving to see more of, but again, honoring the parameters that the performers and the bodies engaging in the work are telling you. And that listening skill, I think, I can only attribute it to just time, right? Of just being in so many different rooms and working with so many types of bodies and people that you just have sort of a profound fluency in listening is what I would say.
Yeah, I think that what you said, which is important, is that each room is different.
Yes.
And each actor's body is different. And so as intimacy choreography advances through our theater world, I think it's important, because I have been in the room, not as an intimacy choreographer, when someone else was. And it's tricky because sometimes a lot of warning signs are put up between actors when there was no need to. And so in the creative process, reading the room of how we are consenting and keeping it safe, keeping the impulses of the actors still open to the intimacy while remaining safe, I think is the tricky thing. You know, yeah. There may be an actor who really, you can tell by looking at them, they're very shy, or they're, this is new, or they're unsure. You, the intimacy director, have to pick that up. Somebody else is like, I'm fine, touch me anywhere, right? But if those two are paired up, then how you work that so that the actor who's like, you can touch me anywhere, I'm fine, is not, doesn't lose patience, and the other actor doesn't feel pushed. It is about, like, it's tricky to, it's like you don't want to over boundary the space between two actors, yet you do want to keep it safe and consented. So that's what I find is the challenging part of this role.
Definitely. It's just micro adjustments in real time. And that just takes, again, I think, a considerable amount of care and patience, and again, yeah, sort of experience in understanding the sort of individual needs of the room, which, yeah.
And also the director. I mean, working with you is incredible. So that's, I can't even use that as an example because it's so, it goes so smoothly. But I've been in the room with other directors where, you know, it's very tricky. They don't want you directing so doing the intimacy choreography without stepping on the director's toes, you know, working together is also, it takes a skill.
Totally.
Because every director has different parameters of how they want to work.
Yes. And I think that I can only speak for myself, but I am not trained in doing intimacy work. And so what I just fully surrender to the fact that that is not my skill set, and that is not my expertise, and that is your expertise, and that is your skill set. And so again, the trust that I place in you in the room is not just because we've collaborated a bunch or whatever, it's because I know that you know how to synthesize the idea of the image that I desire, and you know how to say it in your own way and in your own articulation, and that there is an open channel between us. If, like, I, you know, one of us throws out an idea, that we can, like, so respectfully be like, that's a great idea, but I don't know if that's going to work, or yes, let's try it, or whatever. I don't think that I can a singular time where we have been in creative conversation in a room together where there's been a dispute.
No, and we can toss something out. We toss things out. Let's try this. No, it's no good. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's just so, it's so open. And I think that, like, again, like, in the desire to remove these hierarchical structures that tend to exist in theatrical rooms and processes, right? Like, I know that if that is not my skill set, why am I going to try to, like, hold on to that, the preciousness of it being my idea or whatever? Like, that's actually just doing a disservice to everyone in the room, and most importantly to your actor, right? Who at the end of the day are the people embodying the image and embodying the language, you know? Yeah.
But the thing about, that's why I say intimacy choreographer is what I do, is because the director has a vision of how he wants the actors touching, you know, what is the milieu, what is the intention, all of that. So again, not talking about you, because you and I are in sync, but working with other directors who have a very specific thing in mind, it's a little bit of a different muscle.
Totally.
Because they don't say, okay, if I go work that out, they might not know me, that they don't trust me that much, or, right? I might be walking in with a director that doesn't know me. So then it's working with the director beat by beat, and me consenting each movement, the director saying the moves he wants, right? It's a little bit of a different practice, which isn't bad or good. It's just different.
It's just different.
Yeah.
And then I think that the last thing that I want to say about like just my particular experience with your intimacy work that I think is so powerful and important is the rituals that you give and endow the room with of how to exit that space of intimacy, right? Or to exit that energetic sort of charge that being in these moments can create for a performer's body and more importantly, their mind, right? Yeah. Like, how do you shed that off at the end of your day and at the end of working that scene or that moment? And that is something that I've so profoundly learned from you and watching your process is that like you have really tangible rituals to give an actor, which I think gives me a lot of peace when you are not in the room with me to sort of activate that ritual.
Activate
that care when you're not there.
I think it's one of my biggest passions is to get actors to take the time to neutralize that energy between themselves and the other actor. So they're not walking. It just comes from my own personal experience, you know, being on stage with someone that love affair is happening and then it's dragged outside of the rehearsal room.
Yeah.
Somebody's following somebody home or there's a fight or it's just, and you know, real visceral acting will not just stop on its own. I'm not in that story anymore. I'm going back to my life, but the body needs a ritual. It needs time. It needs to come back palm to palm with the actor. I was acting. How are you? Let's neutralize that. And the more I do that, the happier I am about how effective it is.
Yeah, it's profound.
Finally, I can't believe we've been talking so long. But I could talk to you forever. Is there something you are coming into? Are you directing something soon that you can tell our listeners about that we can look forward to?
Yes. So I am actually currently collaborating with my fiance. Her name is Softie. She's a musician and also an amazing actor. But we have released a series of music videos that you can check out on the Softie YouTube page. There's an amazing video that we worked on called Come Home and Red Light, Green Light and some other really fun projects. She's going on tour next month. Wow. So we're going to be taking some of our, you know, music video visuals and materializing it to live performance.
Amazing.
Which is really exciting. And we're incorporating drag performers and really sort of honoring a very queer Brooklyn sensibility to the live show, which I'm really excited about.
And fantastic. How do we find it? Can you spell it out?
Yes. Softie, Softee, like the ice cream, like the soft serve. You can find her music on Spotify, Amazon Music.
And spell her name.
Apple Music. And Nina Grohlman is her full name, but Softie, Softee is the musician.
Great. So I'm going to go, as soon as I hang up here, I'm going to go look at that.
Yes. Listen to the jams.
Yeah.
Take you into your spring. Yes.
Yes. And you must come to the stage reading of my play on May 10th.
Please send me the details.
Saga of Sage, May 10th, because I want you to probably direct it.
Oh my gosh. What an honor. Yes. Send me all of the details. How fun. I would love to check it out.
Michelle, thank you so much for being here. Thank you. What a great conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be in conversation with you today. I love being your collaborator and your friend, and this was so much fun.
Thank you. And those listeners, look, we have a lot of classes going on this spring and summer. We have international virtual drop-ins, which is a great way to get to know the work. I have a masterclass coming up, two retreats, one in Costa Rica and one in Sicily.
Wait, can I sign up? Or
yes, you can. Go to the lucidbody.com website and see all that we've got going on this spring and this summer. And until we all meet again, thank you for listening. Stay lucid. See you later. Bye, Michelle.
Bye, Faye.